part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of northern and central Illinois, western Indiana, and Lake Michigan, effective this Thursday afternoon and evening until 6 o'clock. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Ford, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, DeWitt, Piatt, and Moultrie. A severe thunderstorm watch in effect for portions of northern and central Illinois, western Indiana, and Lake Michigan until 6 o'clock this evening. In this portion of the afternoon magazine, we dip into the archives for an interview with writer Rachel Cohen. We talked with her on June 8th of this year. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Our guest today, writer Rachel Cohen. We're going to talk with her about her journey into American history, arts, and letters. Rachel Cohen is the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. The book begins with Henry James and his father in the studio of Matthew Brady. It closes with Norman Mailer and Robert Lowell sharing mugs of bourbon in Washington ahead of a march on the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. In between, you'll find stories of Willa Cather, W.E.B. Du Bois, Zora Neale Hurston, Joseph Cornell, John Cage, and Marianne Moore, among others. Rachel Cohen says these lives came and went during the fruitful, difficult period that held two related struggles, the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. Let me quote further from the introduction to A Chance Meeting. The 30 people gathered here met in ordinary ways, a careful arrangement after long admiration, a friend's casual introduction, or because they both just happened to be standing near the drinks. Some of their encounters left a memorable impression, though they never spoke again. On other occasions, strong and altering loyalties emerged, permanent conditions of influence were established, and acts of rebellion were set in motion. Writing of their own lives, they very often identified the crucial shifts as having happened in the moment of going through a new door or in the grasp of an unfamiliar hand. Our guest, Rachel Cohen, has written for many publications, including The New Yorker. Her essays appeared in Best American Essays 2003 and the 2003 Pushcart Anthology. She won the 2003 Penn Girard Fund Award for the manuscript of A Chance Meeting, and she teaches at Sarah Lawrence College. A Chance Meeting is published by Random House. Rachel Cohen, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
You say many of the people gathered here in A Chance Meeting began keeping you company a decade ago. You were driving around the U.S. and you were traveling with lots of books. Tell us about that year and the books you packed for the journey.
Yeah, it was an interesting year. It was a year where I thought that I was going to write a book sort of like John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, or anyway, that was my great dream. And so I was driving around looking for the kind of stories that he found and told in that book. And I found that I wasn't John Steinbeck, and that I certainly couldn't tell that story. And instead, I was reading all the books in my trunk, and I had Mark Twain because I was going to drive down the Mississippi, and I had a lot of Willa Cather, and then I bought books along the way in all the used bookstores I encountered, and gradually I accumulated this other set of American stories.
Yeah. Well, you're a very good storyteller.
Oh, thank you. That's kind.
I've really enjoyed reading the stories that you tell in this book. You say that when you were reading those books on that year traveling around, you were reading them differently. You were reading them in a different way than you had read in the past. You were really interested in who those people were, who mm-hmm. those writers were. What inspired that new consideration of writers and artists?
I think I was myself trying to be a writer, so of course I was looking for models for how people did things and how they lived and how work got made. But I also think
This is meteorologist Ed Kieser with a weather bulletin from the National Weather Service. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for DeWitt and Macon counties until 2:15 p.m. At 1:08 p.m., which is 3 minutes ago, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm 11 miles west of Kenny, or about 9 miles southeast of Lincoln, moving east at 30 miles per hour. Kenny, Maroa, and Clinton, also Argenta and Weldon, are in the path of the storm. And it will produce frequent lightning, so move indoors, stay away from windows and high objects, and stay away from using a corded telephone or other corded devices. These storms have already produced a lot of lightning and also are capable of damaging winds and large hail. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning is in effect for DeWitt and Macon counties until 2:15 p.m. A severe thunderstorm watch remains in effect for our entire severe weather coverage area until 6 o'clock. We now return you to your program.
Business partners in that publishing venture, but they were good friends, weren't they?
They were good friends. They had real admiration for each other. Grant loved Twain's book, Innocents Abroad, and when he went abroad, he traveled with it. And Twain thought Grant was the most admirable sort of huge figure of his time. They really had a close friendship in lots of ways.
Yeah. The period that you cover here, 1854 to 1967, that's a lot of time, at least it seems so to me, more than 100 years. How did you decide which chance meetings you'd like to consider?
It was really hard because there were so many interesting stories, and it seemed so necessary to have them all. So that winnowing process took years, actually, of putting things in and taking them out again. But I knew I wanted to start around the time just before the Civil War because I thought that was a moment where Americans were really self-conscious in a way that they hadn't been before that, and where American art was beginning to have its own stature and considerations that were different than it had had. And I knew I wanted to end around the time of the Civil Rights Movement because I felt that a lot of the divisions that turned up in the Civil War kind of turned up again in the Civil Rights Movement, and you could see a lot of the same questions returning to the country at that time. So that was one way of choosing, was to sort of stay within that framework and to think about the things which were affected by those events.
Yeah. I have one more question drawn from the introduction. James Baldwin and Henry James, you kept them in your mind throughout the research and writing of this book. Baldwin quoted James when he wrote in Paris what it meant to him to be an American. He knew James, but he never met him, and the same goes for you with most of these folks. What has it meant for you getting to know these writers and artists through their work and their lives?
It's been really interesting. I think to me it seems like every artist or writer puts a huge amount of his or her life into the act of making things and the act of making art. And so studying the lives was a way of understanding what the art meant to them and why they wanted to make it. And it seemed to me to be different in each case, that each person's conception of that was different. So, and then that they were all different again by who was studying them. Like James Baldwin's Henry James is different than mine. Mm-hmm. But the way that he understood James helps me to understand James for myself.
Hmm. Did it take you by surprise that there were so many generosities, so many kindnesses in the lives of these people?
In a way it did, although I think that's also what I was most interested in. So it was partly what I was looking for, was the ways in which people had helped each other both in artistic collaboration and just in saying, well done, you know, which everybody needs to hear sometimes.
Yeah.
But there were moments that I just was astonished by where I thought, oh, I had no idea, say, that Mark Twain had no intention of writing Life on the Mississippi until William Dean Howells said, you know, I really think you would do that well.
And who was it that spurred Willa Cather to quit magazine work and to write novels?
Right. Her mentor, Sarah Orne Jewett, was incredibly important in making that decision. And Jewett said to her very wisely, you are not going to be able to do it if you stay in the office. You have got to get out into the world and write your novels. And she did.
There's also, though, some competitiveness here and there.
Inevitably.
Here and there and everywhere. I'm thinking of Mailer.
Yeah, and, yeah, Norman
and
Mailer.
Robert Lowell.
Yeah, they I think had a really interesting interaction. Just Mailer was incredibly competitive, and so was Lowell in his way. And Lowell was, to Mailer's mind, a Boston Brahmin with sort of generations of family behind him and impressive stature. And Mailer thought of himself as a Jew from Brooklyn with none of those things. And so when they met, he was really pugnacious with Lowell. But then gradually they started to have a lot of respect for each other. And that, I think, really emerges during the course of Mailer's book, Armies of the Night.
Mm-hmm. The first chapter is the chapter where we see Henry James and his father, Henry James Sr., in the studio of Matthew Brady.
Mm-hmm.
And the first chapter opens with a wonderful photograph.
Oh, yeah.
Of the two. Would you describe it for us?
Sure. It's the small Henry James, then about 11, standing on a box to make him a little higher, with his arm on, sort of leaning on his father's shoulder, and his father is holding a cane and is bald. And there's something, I think, in Henry James's little expression that's very evocative. It's hard not to feel that the little boy is thinking about something. And many years later in his autobiography, when he wrote about that moment, he said that he was having this acute feeling of self-consciousness about his family and what it meant that they were American. And that this was partly because he had on this jacket, which he had heard from a family friend recently, had too many buttons on it. And that this was an American impropriety in dress, and he then felt very uncomfortable in his jacket, as many people feel in photographs. And so that's the sort of beginning moment of the book, is that question of self-consciousness that he had.
Yeah, this carries through that question, I think, start to finish, is I would say is the overriding theme.
Yeah, yeah.
The self-consciousness, what does it mean to be an American? It's something that I think we continue to grapple with over and over and over again.
Yeah, I at least to me that seemed right. It seemed like something that had preoccupied a lot of these artists. And for a long time, those definitions were always made in contradistinction to Europe. You thought, oh, I am not an English writer, or I am not a French one, and that somehow makes me an American one. But even that, I think, is harder to sustain in our current world, which is so multidimensional. And so it's very hard to figure out what it is to be an American writer.
Yeah. Henry James became an English citizen.
Yeah, he did. Right during World War I, when he felt that the United States should have entered the war, and he just despaired. He felt it was a huge lack of humanitarianism to have stayed out of international affairs as they had done. And so he became an English citizen at that point, having lived in England for a long time. But he really always thought of himself as an American novelist.
Mm. The poet Marianne Moore appears in this essay. She's here because of her essay, Henry James as a Characteristic American.
Mm-hmm.
What pulled her toward James?
I think primarily or first his language, that she's a masterful user of words, Marianne Moore, and I think she loved the way James used language. And also again, self-consciousness, a kind of turning inward and turning over certain possibilities that she also is a ruminator in some ways in her work. And I think she wanted him to be part of the American tradition. That was really important to her. She wanted him to be part of her American tradition. And that was partly why she wrote that essay.
Mm. Well, jumping ahead to Marianne Moore and the artist Joseph Cornell now, if we
mm-hmm.
could. I had no idea that they had such a friendship. You know, it was a delightful surprise. What would you like to say about these two and their relationship?
The way they knew each other.
Yeah.
That was one that also came as a delight to me, because once I knew about it, they seemed so perfect for each other.
Yeah.
I didn't realize until I started reading the correspondence of each of them that they had known each other. Joseph Cornell was an incredible collector. That was really how he made his art, by going and picking up treasures in secondhand stores and cutting paper pictures out of magazines and assembling those into his wonderful boxes. And Marianne Moore was like that, too. She was really, she was a magpie. She collected quotations, and she collected things from old books, and she collected things from movies and from the zoo and all kinds of places. And so they just had a very common sensibility. But then they were both very shy, and each lived with his or her mother, and they barely went out sometimes. And so it was a very tentative friendship in certain ways, and an incredibly formal and polite one.
Mm. It seems to me that in recently here we've seen new interest in the work of Joseph Cornell, and Marianne Moore is once again appearing on bookshelves in bookstores. For a long time, I think these two were relatively lost. What do you suppose is going on with that? Would you make the same observation?
Yeah, I think that's true. Part of it is just the way people inevitably go in and out of a sort of fame, and part of it is the sort of hazards of book publishing. Is there an in-print collected edition? That the recent Marianne Moore collected is certainly reminds people of her existence, but I think also there's something about their sensibility, about the erudition that they both had, and the strangeness of the collections that each made, that isn't to the taste of every moment, and maybe is particularly to our taste right now.
Mm. And Marianne Moore was a supporter of the war in Vietnam. I wonder if that cost her.
Certainly, politically, she was on the right. In a moment when people turned more toward the left, people in the arts turned more toward the left, and that may be difficult. But she was wildly popular in her late period, in her old age, and then really fell off. I think it's very hard to be a famous woman writer. It was interesting to me in going back how many really fine women writers had faded from view.
Mm. Do you think that's why we don't have many women who've written travel narratives? That's what you set out to do here.
I think it's a related but slightly different problem. It takes a great deal of confidence to impose a narrative on a landscape. I think that's a really difficult thing to do. And I think it does come more easily to men than to women, to sort of be in that position. And then there are some actual practical things that it's, there are issues of safety and so that I think it can be harder. There are some fine women travel writers, but not nearly as many as men.
Mm. And maybe it is that they don't cover a large landscape, but they focus closer to home or in one particular area.
Yeah, and maybe stay longer also. Like there are, for example, fantastic letters of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who went to live in Turkey with her husband in, I think, the 18th century. But she stayed in one place and wrote her letters from there. And that may be a little bit more the woman's style of traveling, if there are gendered styles.
Mm. Makes me want to pack suitcases of books and go off somewhere. Not so much to move around.
Yeah. It's a good thing to do. I recommend it. Yeah.
Yeah. Of all the encounters here, of all the chance meetings, of all the friendships, are you equally fond of all of them, or do you have your favorites?
Oh, I have my favorites, although I love many. I would say all of them in different ways, and sort of couldn't do without any of them. But there are people who are closer to my heart in one way or another. Henry James, I think, is someone like that. I really just keep going back to his work and keep trying to fathom it and feel that I haven't, and find that satisfying. And Joseph Cornell is someone whose work I love. And then there are people whose appearance I really enjoy in this. Like, I really enjoy Charlie Chaplin walking into Hart Crane's bedroom in the middle of the night because they were all going to go out drinking, and Hart Crane just getting so thrilled and excited to see Charlie Chaplin. And that moment, that sort of shock of Charlie Chaplin coming through the door is a favorite moment of mine.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was fascinating to read about William James and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah, that is a really interesting moment, I think. When William James was the professor of both Gertrude Stein and W.E.B. Du Bois, and they both learned an enormous amount from him, and they went on to be so influential in completely different circles and areas. He had a lot of students who were very devoted to him, and he really seemed to be able to do that great teachers can do of just making you feel that you want to go further and know more and be more yourself. And then W.E.B. Du Bois really had a profound impact on on basically a century of political and philosophical history. And you can see roots of that in his interactions with William James.
Yeah. Tell us the story about William James and W.E.B. Du Bois going to see Helen Keller.
Helen Keller. Isn't that incredible? Yeah, because it was a thing that people did in that moment in the 1890s. They went out to see Helen Keller, who was this phenomenon that she could kind of communicate with people even though she couldn't see and couldn't hear. And so, and she was in an institute near Cambridge, near where they were, and so they spent the day together going out to visit Helen Keller and coming back, and they were very impressed by her and her teacher and Anne Sullivan, and they both remembered the event for a long time, and Helen Keller remembered it too and actually sent birthday greetings to W.E.B. Du Bois, I think about 70 years later.
Do you think it had some impact on his development of the idea of double consciousness?
It might have. I think certainly the sort of psychological teachings of William James were part of that. The phrase double consciousness was in use in psychology at that moment, and that was part of, I think, where he came to it. And certainly he was always very interested in different people's experiences of the world, and he would have, I think, related to Helen Keller's being in the world and yet not quite being able to be in the world because of her sort of different sensory experience.
Yeah. There's something that you write at the end of that essay. It is about, forgive me, it is either William James or Du Bois in terms of, and maybe you've taken a little political license here in this idea of imaginative nonfiction, which maybe we can talk about in a moment, but you talk about these two men meeting Helen Keller and then the idea of holding language in your hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's there's no documentary evidence that they thought that, but the way that Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan communicated was by making signs that they pressed into each other's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would obviously have been something that they would have experienced that day, watching that communication happen. And they were both very interested in the sort of communication that's possible between people and the different forms it can take. And I'm very interested in the sort of fact of shaking somebody's hand, or in this extreme case, making language with your hands, and what kind of communication is possible.
Yeah. Now, as an essayist in writing these encounters, how did you make the distinction of fleshing things out and maybe going too far? Was that a concern of yours?
Absolutely, it was. It was, yeah. I felt that I needed to be able to imagine just a little bit because I wanted to convey an effect of immediacy, of the feeling of being in a room with somebody. I thought that was important to the whole endeavor. But on the other hand, I didn't want to make things up that were out of character or that seemed presumptuous. So I was constantly checking everything and trying to see if I had the right sources and if things were close enough that it seemed I could say them, and I would get outside confirmation, and that would be reassuring. Like I in one piece, I have Elizabeth Bishop being late for Marianne Moore, and she's very worried about being late. And Elizabeth Bishop was, in fact, often late, and but I wasn't sure if that was the right way to begin. And then I found a letter from Marianne Moore saying that she really liked Elizabeth Bishop, but she particularly hated that she was always late. And then I thought, oh, this is a good sign for what I've invented. And then I've read an essay by George Plimpton in which he said that Marianne Moore was so obsessed with being on time that she always wore two watches. And so then I thought, well, this is fine. This is completely in character that Marianne Moore would be early and Elizabeth Bishop would be late, and this is the right sort of way to open their scene together. But it took a lot of pieces of evidence for me to feel sure that I had done my imagining well.
Yeah. I really enjoy reading the form of the essay.
Thanks.
And I wonder what it's like, what kind of satisfaction does an essayist get from writing an essay?
Oh, what a nice question. Yeah, I think the essay form is my favorite form. I love it, and I think it doesn't get talked about that much. There are a lot of different satisfactions. You can get quite close to the pleasures of a short story, of a narrative shape, an arc in which things happen to characters, or there are turns of story that are satisfying in the way that a fiction writer would have. And you can also make an argument, kind of build something persuasive, and that is quite different. And you can do a sort of fragmented collage kind of form, and that has different pleasures again. So it's really, I think, a marvelous and flexible form
in that way. I think it's almost as if the essayist is whispering to his or her reader, in a sense, because it's also the essay, the form, I think, it reveals things about the essayist.
I think that's exactly right. Even when it's not a personal essay, there's always a clear voice, and there are decisions about what's included and what's not included that indicate who the person is who's writing. I think it's a very conversational form, and has for a long, long time been close to letter writing as a form. Though the letter is to a more general reader, not to one specific reader.
Writer and essayist Rachel Cohen is our guest here this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with the telephone call. Join us with your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, let's go back in time. Let's go back to the second chapter now of A Chance Meeting. Here, boy, what a circle of people. We've got William Dean Howells. The focus is on William Dean Howells, Annie Adams Fields, and Walt Whitman, but there are many other luminaries here. Nathaniel Hawthorne, for example. We have Nathaniel Hawthorne in Boston telling Howells, who was from Ohio, how he'd like to go to Ohio. That is, Hawthorne would, because, quote, the damned shadow of Europe hadn't fallen there. And continuing on reading that essay, I wonder how Howells thought of that, because he is a seeker of, I think, of things European.
Especially at that point, when he's a young man, I think about 20, and just coming east for the first time to the centers of culture that he's been reading about in Ohio all this time. And so, yeah, they kind of met at opposite moments. Hawthorne, much later in his life, having seen plenty of Europe and now really wanting to move away from that shadow, and Howells on his way to it. Later, I think Howells would understand much better what Hawthorne had meant, but in that moment, I think he must have been surprised.
And Howells, how did his view of Walt Whitman change over time?
When he actually reviewed a fairly early edition of Leaves of Grass, and he didn't really like it. He was a little scandalized by it. And he was always the person who didn't want to talk too much about sex, so he really thought Whitman was out there in that way. But gradually over the years, he sort of realized that Whitman was an unbelievable poet and came to feel that he was one of America's finest writers. But Howells had this extremely influential magazine, The Atlantic, that he was the editor of for more than a decade, and he published really everybody there. He published Twain, and he published Henry James, and he published Sarah Orne Jewett, and he never published Whitman. So there's a way in which he never quite came all the way around.
Yeah. It's interesting today, I think, that most of us would feel, if we were to describe ourselves as a Howells American or a Whitman American, we'd fall into the camp, probably, most of us, of being Whitman, more like Whitman Americans.
That's how we would think of ourselves?
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, in fact, I think probably a lot of us are Howells Americans. I mean, what Howells wrote about were domestic establishments, families, very often middle-class families who were struggling to understand the world and sometimes facing divorce and trying to kind of raise children and not get too absorbed by money and stay sympathetic to the working class people that they knew. And all of those things are struggles that we all, I think, still have. But we don't know that Howells wrote the novels about it 100 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I have not read William Dean Howells.
Neither have most people. But he's a fine novelist and a very sympathetic person and an excellent critic. So, yeah, he's worth reading.
Hmm. Over the course of these years, 1854 to 1967, what impact does technology and industrialization have on the character of America?
It makes a difference, I think. One of the preoccupations throughout this book is the question of social mobility and geographical mobility. People are moving all the time, and that's part of how they're meeting each other. They're coming into, especially cities, and coming to know people in that colliding way that people do in cities. There are some specific technological inventions that make a difference. Mark Twain started writing on a typewriter. People gradually come to use different kinds of technology in making their work. And photography is important throughout the book. There are lots of photographers and people sitting for photographs. And the changes in photographic technology make a difference in those things, how quickly cameras could shoot, what size pictures they took, how photographers imagined themselves to be documenting the world. So those things matter. But in some ways, people stuck to very similar forms of communication all the way through. They talked to each other. They wrote letters. And they kind of knew each other in kind of intimate and immediate ways.
Hmm. Ulysses Grant studied drawing at West Point because generals had to have a grasp of the terrain and they had to map it out.
Yep.
It was a military skill.
And then
here again we've got Matthew Brady on the scene during the Civil War, the coming of the medium of photography.
Taking pictures of battlefields. Yeah, and they used those pictures. It was during the Civil War that the War Department started to see that you could learn a lot from having a good photograph, and they actually sent people up in balloons to take larger photographs, which were the first aerial photographs in that war. So you can see that a lot. And then other later photographers who I wrote about, like Edward Steichen, also went to war and was among the first to take photographs from planes. And those kinds of things had a real military effect as well as an effect on the way that people saw the war.
Hmm. Walt Whitman saw photography as American, but he wasn't interested in it as historical record. What drew Whitman to the medium?
I think in a way he did think of it as a historical record, but it was he sort of imagined a historical record that could be made out of photographs, although he knew that there would have to be other things too, in a way. But I think the newness of it and the quickness of it and also the democracy of it, that everybody could have his or her photograph taken, was so different than portrait painting, which had been reserved for the upper classes. And so suddenly in that period, you have everybody getting dressed up and going to the daguerreotype studio or the photograph studio and having their picture taken. It's a completely different sense of who's valuable, who's worth having their picture taken.
Mm. Would you describe the photograph of Zora Neale Hurston that's in the book?
Sure, that's one of my favorites. That was taken by her friend Carl Van Vechten, who was also a friend of Gertrude Stein's and of Langston Hughes's. And he was a kind of amateur photographer who got very excited and started just collecting people, just taking everybody's photograph. She was a wonderful writer and had a very vivacious presence, which I think comes across in that picture. So you see her kind of laughing, and she has a hat with a feather in it, and I think looks very very much like she's sort of open to the world, which she was in that moment.
Yeah, I think Whitman would have liked that photograph.
I think that's true, actually. It's a nice observation.
Yeah. Let's move on to Twain and go back to him. I guess we've talked a little bit about him earlier in the interview. Mm. What would you like to say about Samuel Clemens? He appears a number of times in this book, A Chance Meeting.
It's true. I'm very fond of Twain, as I think many people are, and I think you find, going back to read him, that he kind of gives endlessly, that there's always more there than you than you realized. And when I was rereading him driving down the Mississippi, kind of looking again at Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, which I had read in junior high school or whatever it was, and I loved without really understanding many of the things that were in them. So I think he's a person that people I know are somehow always reading one way and another. And he was a very difficult person to write about, actually, because he's such a larger-than-life figure and has been written about so many times. It's hard to figure out how to find your way into talking about him in a way that will make him feel like a person instead of like a legend. But he was very warm in his friendships, very close to William Dean Howells, and their correspondence is beautiful to read and very funny also. So you start to see him in relation to other people, and that helps to see him as they saw him, at least.
Yeah. You know, after reading Howells about Howells and you know, thinking when he was a young man that Whitman was kind of out there, I was surprised to see Howells as an admirer of Twain. He called him the Lincoln of our literature.
He did. He loved his work. Well, I think the ways that Twain and Whitman were out there were a little different, because Twain is a really understood boyhood and politics. Those were things that he wrote brilliantly about. He doesn't write so much about sex. That's not really his subject. So he didn't frighten Howells in that way. And Howells had grown up in Ohio, also near a river, and one of his uncles had been a steamboat captain, and he really recognized the world that Twain came out of and the vernacular that Twain also loved. And so they did splendidly together. They really had a grand time.
Mm. It sounds to me like when you were researching and writing this, writing A Chance Meeting, that you had many chance meetings. You had chance meetings with people's correspondence, and one thing I would imagine led you, you know, here, there, mm-hmm. you know, through one door and then through another door. Give us some sense of what your life was like while you were working on this project, which took you a number of years. It must have been, you know, consuming.
It was consuming. It was in a very pleasurable way. I loved being in the world of this book and miss it now, actually, not to be working on it. But yeah, it was. I read between 300 and 400 books, so that was a lot. I was in books a lot of the time, and I started to read biographies by the index first, which is the sad sign of somebody who's looking for something in particular. And I was online a lot, because there were a lot of period details that were online about ladies' uh-huh. hats and what kinds of carriages people had and who got into them first and all those kinds of things. And then I was really just, as you say, kind of in search of these different kinds of meetings. So reading through correspondence and thinking, oh, there's that person, so they did know each other, or finding a photograph, oh, paging through Avedon photographs and seeing a photograph of John Cage and thinking, oh, so Avedon photographed Cage, so that's, you know, that connection is made and I could do something with that. That was very exciting. It was quite a thrill to find many of those things.
I imagine these people showed up in your dreams on a regular basis.
They practically did, and I occasionally had to stop myself from talking about them as if I really did know them. You know, Willa Cather always says this, or because I felt all the time that I was talking, you know, near them, if not really to them.
Yeah. Did you have friends from time to time say, Rachel?
She's kind of been dead for a while.
Come out with us this evening.
Those kinds of things would happen. Yeah. But mostly my friends were very sympathetic, which was nice, because yeah. they had to hear quite a lot about all of these people.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, going back and finding out information about clothing and what the streets look like in a city. Maybe you would talk with us about some of the fun things that you learned about what these people did for entertainment. What kinds of entertainments did they enjoy?
Yeah, there are some nice things, especially, I think, earlier things would seem a little quaint to us. Like, it was so common to go for a walk as something that you did with a friend, or to take a carriage ride to look at a view. Those were activities, which we don't really think of as activities anymore. And then there were funny things also, like Carl Van Vechten and Langston Hughes meeting on the floor of a speakeasy and up in Harlem, and kind of, I mean, everybody just getting plastered and wildly dancing. And so there's quite a range of entertainment. Marianne Moore liked to go to baseball games and to fights. And there are other people who go to boxing matches in this. Norman Mailer and James Baldwin, I think, not accidentally had their final battle after a boxing match. There's quite a range, and all those things contribute to the way people understand each other.
The movies come along in this period of time.
Yeah, they do. They do, which is part of the reason I was happy to have Charlie Chaplin along for the ride. Many of these people love the movies. W.E.B. Du Bois went to the movies all the time. So did Marianne Moore and Elizabeth Bishop. And it was another kind of narrative, which they also were excited about, and a visual understanding of the world, which many of the photographers I was writing about cared about, too.
Yeah. The people in this book who never met, if you could bring them, a group of them, together, who would you like to put together around a table?
That would be really fun. And another thing I think of is people who I would like for them to have known the work of people who came after them. You know, like I think Matthew Brady and Mark Twain, for different reasons, would have found Joseph Cornell's work really fascinating. I think Henry James would have been glad to know about the poetry that Elizabeth Bishop and Marianne Moore wrote.
This is meteorologist Ed Kieser with a weather bulletin from the National Weather Service. The National Weather Service has now issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Piatt County in central Illinois in effect until 2:45 p.m. At 1:46 p.m. a minute ago, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm over Cisco, or about 8 miles west of Monticello, moving toward the east at 30 miles per hour. So this storm is heading toward Monticello, Bement, and White Heath. And this storm will be producing frequent lightning, so you should stay indoors, away from trees and high objects, and stay off corded telephones as well. The storms today are producing lots of lightning. So repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning is in effect for Piatt County until 2:45 p.m. In addition, Macon and DeWitt counties remain under a severe thunderstorm warning until 2:15 p.m., and our entire severe weather coverage area is under a severe thunderstorm watch until 6 p.m. We now return you to your program.
That you asked about. And people are often curious to know also, like, how I chose who to put in and who not to put in. There's always the question of, if it's a party, you know, how did you make up the invitation list? And it's not only a party, I hasten to add. But
right.
But there is that question of how to make those decisions. And certainly I made some of them for the kinds of historical reasons that I was talking about. And also I made a lot of them out of an instinct for just who I felt I might be able to write about in a way that would make them vivid. And then I was interested in certain lines of influence, so I was also trying to put together the kinds of things you noticed, like Henry James sort of reemerging with James Baldwin, or I think in some ways the kind of humor of Mark Twain emerging again with Marcel Duchamp and John Cage.
Mm. Is there, looking back on it now, is there a person or persons that you now like to put in the book?
Oh, there were lots of people who I was sorry not to have in.
Yeah.
And there were all kinds of other lines I would like to have taken. I would have liked to write about photographers who were not portrait photographers, although I only wrote about portrait photographers. So then I would have written about Walker Evans because I love his work. But he didn't really fit in the world that I was making. And then there are all kinds of other people. I thought that it didn't make sense to write about painters in this way. I felt that these sort of short glimpses were not the way that you look at painting, that you have to go back and back to painting to really understand it. But had I had a form which made sense for painting, then I would love to have written about Mark Rothko or others of the abstract expressionists. So there were lots of people who I sorrowfully turned down.
Yeah. Now, has this project led you to what you're going to do next or what you're doing now?
I remain really interested in the conjunction of imagination and research, you know, in those sort of two projects, and certainly in biography and the kind of, in making vivid historical characters. But I'm not quite sure what new form that will take. I'd like, since the essay form does allow you so many directions, I'd like to try something else. But I think I may actually try to move toward poets and painters for the next round.
Mm. Well, maybe we'll meet again.
That would be a huge pleasure.
Thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Rachel Cohen has been our guest in this portion of the program. She is the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. The book is published by Random House. And that interview conducted on June 8th of this year. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Dave Dickey is standing by this afternoon with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. He also has the highs and lows on the day. Dave?
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a very, very rough day at the Chicago Board of Trade. The August spot soybean contract falling limit down, while the September and December corn contracts going through some technical support levels. We'll get to all the details here in just a second. First, looking at the wheat. September wheat, a high of 326.5, a low of 322 settling. 322 and three quarters down 1.25. December, a high of 339.5, a low of 335 and three quarters. Settling 336.25 down 1.25. March, a high of 359.5, a low of 347. Settling 347 and three quarters down a half. May, a high of 354, a low of 350, settling on the low down 1. July, a high of 354, a low of 352.5, settling at 352 and three quarters down 1.5. September corn, a high on the day of 225 and three quarters, a low of 219, settling 219 and a quarter down 7. September corn has now lost 20 and a quarter cents on the week. December, a high of 234 and a quarter, a low of 227.5, settling 227 and three quarters down 6 and three quarters. March, a high of 242.5, a low of 235.5, settling 236 down 6 and three quarters. May, a high of 248.25, a low of 242, settling on the low down 6.5. July corn, a high of 252.5, a low of 246.25, settling 246.5 down 6.25. September, a high of 255.75, a low of 250, settling on the low down 5.25 on the day. September oats, a high of 127.5, a low of 123.25, settling 124.25, down 3.25. December, a high of 133.75, a low of 131, settling 131.75, down 1.75. August soybeans, a high of 713, a low of 657.5, settling on the low, limit down 50. September, a high of 632, a low of 598. Yes, it invaded the $6 level and settled at $6.50 down 26.25. November, a high of 617, a low of 592.5, settling 593.75 down 18.25. January, a high of 622, a low of 599, settling 599.5 down 21. March beans, a high of 624, a low of 606, settling 607.5 down 17.5. May, a high of 630, a low of 609, settling 609.5 down 19. August soybean meal was limit down at one point today before coming back off the lows, a high on the day of 240.20. A low of 217.80, settling 219 down 18.80. September, a high of 215, a low of 196, settling 196.30 down 17.50. August soybean oil, a high of 25.47, a low of 24.39, settling 24.40 down 99. September, a high of 24.40, a low of 23.74, settling 23.75 down 71 on the day. The prices are also in from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and Celeste. We see that we have a lot of higher prices today. There was a story out that the United States and Japan have took a step closer to resuming trade of U.S. beef to Japan, and the markets reacted accordingly.
Okay, but before we get to that information, we're going to bring you some weather information. Thank you.
National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a tornado. Yes, I can hear you, Jason. There's a tornado warning for Piatt County in central Illinois. Actually, that was traffic from the TV station. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a tornado warning for Piatt County in central Illinois until 2:45 p.m. At 1:54 p.m., which is 2 minutes ago, radar indicated a severe thunderstorm with strong rotation over Cisco, or about 6 miles west of Monticello, moving to the east at 30 miles per hour, so that's heading toward Monticello. This storm could produce a tornado at any time. In addition to the threat of a tornado, large hail and damaging winds can be expected with the storm. Go to a safe place now. The tornado is expected to be moving over the Monticello area, also perhaps Lodge and White Heath. And also in the warning is DeLand. Tornado warning for Piatt County until 2:45 p.m. And now we just received word that there's a severe thunderstorm warning for Champaign and Douglas counties until 3 o'clock. As of a minute ago, the radar showing a line of severe thunderstorms from 11 miles west of Monticello to 14 miles north of Sullivan, moving east at 35 miles per hour. Tuscola, Pasotum, Seymour, Arcola, Tolono, Villa Grove, Camargo, and Savoy are in the path of that line of storms, which is capable of producing winds in excess of 60 miles per hour, damaging hail and frequent lightning and very heavy rain. So take shelter in a sturdy building and stay away from windows. And there is a lot of lightning with all of these storms. So repeating, a tornado warning is in effect for Piatt County, and that warning is in effect until 2:45, a severe thunderstorm warning for Champaign and Douglas counties until 3. DeWitt County is still under a severe thunderstorm warning along with Macon County until 2:15. And also Christian County, neighboring our severe weather coverage area, under a severe thunderstorm warning until 3 o'clock. That just in as well. Stay tuned to WILL for the latest weather information. All of us are under a severe thunderstorm watch until 6 o'clock.
Now let's take a look at what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange. August feeder cattle, 114.70 the high, 112.30 the low, 114.65 the settlement, that up 272.5. September, 113.95 the high, 111.55 the low, 113.67.5 the settlement, that up 252.5. October, 112.02.5 the high, 109.65 the low, 111.75 the settlement, that up 272.5. July live cattle opened limit up at 85 even, that up the limit up $3. August live cattle, 88.15 the high, 86.15 the low, finishing at 87.97.5, that up 272.5. September live cattle, 89.50 the high, the low 85 even, the settlement 89.50, that up the limit up $3. October, 90.12.5 the high. The low today, 87.95, finishing limit up 90.12.5. August lean hogs, 74.55.